dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love. We are pre-recording this program and we'll be focusing on the fast-moving developments in Ukraine and elsewhere up to the moment, but with a focus on conditions likely to persist, but with the understanding that we're taking a snapshot of a highly dynamic situation in that region and globally. To that end, we're going to start off with one of our duty experts on Ukraine, Reuben Johnson. He is a defense consultant and analyst based there. We're catching up with him in Kiev. Reuben, thank you so much for joining us and for, well, your best assessment of both where things stand now and where they're likely to head from here. Give us a readout as you see things at the moment, and as the government of Ukraine and, well, for that matter, the people of Ukraine see them, as to what has already happened, and then we'll get to what's coming in next.
Thank you for having me, Frank, and for focusing on this issue. It's been a very busy last 12 hours or so, because last night the Russian president held a Security Council meeting, part of which was broadcast on Russian television, in which it was declared that the eastern provinces in Ukraine of Donetsk and Lugansk, Vladimir Putin, president of Russia, former KGB lieutenant colonel, announced that Russia was now considering these two provinces to be independent, although no such declaration has been made by them. And that Russia would send in its own troops as peacekeepers. Parts of these two provinces had been occupied by pro-Russian separatist troops that started a rebellion there in 2014, financed by Russia, military hardware supplied by Russia, continually financed by Russia, and Russia continuing to maintain the myth that it's not involved. So this is a rather considerable development, because number one, this has now prompted Boris Johnson, the UK Prime Minister, the current administration in Washington, and others to declare, okay, that's it. This is the invasion. Russia's sending troops into these Ukrainian provinces. This is the invasion. And sanctions have already begun to roll out from many countries, including the Germans, who will withhold certification and halt the Nord Stream 2 pipeline.
We're hearing Joe Biden say that, at least at the moment, Reuben, that this is not an invasion of Ukraine. I guess this falls under the rubric of what he was describing earlier as a minor incursion and not worthy of being treated as the kind of thing that trips a major response. As we're talking, there are sanctions, we're being told, that are going to be announced later in the day. But what's your reading on whether the Ukrainian people and government regard this as an invasion and whether that's appropriate?
Well, I can tell you they do regard it as an invasion, and not just the man on the street, but the Ukrainian military. As of right now, as I speak, there are Ukrainian military units, some of them based in the far west of the country, that are now headed for those eastern provinces. So Putin has done this purposely. As I said earlier, these two provinces, portions of them, have been under the control of pro-Russian separatists since 2014. And so when Putin announces he's sending in his troops to take the rest of these provinces, it's like Adolf Hitler after he got the Sudetenland, and then later he moves on to take all of Czechoslovakia. But what Putin is hoping is that the French and the Germans in particular will look at this and say, oh, well, you know, He kind of already invaded there before. So this is just kind of an expansion of an already existing incursion. And, you know, if we roll out a bunch of sanctions now, that means diplomacy is dead. And this is what the Russians always, always do, is trying to find daylight between the Allies, trying to exploit any kind of fault lines and try to get us to start arguing between each other about whether this is the real thing or not. But Ukrainians consider it, this is an act of hostility. This is not business as usual.
You know, your analogy to the history of Europe prior to World War II is really apt. And I guess Belarus you would consider to be kind of the Anschluss of going into the Nazis, into Austria, unopposed, in fact, welcomed, as I guess they were by the Belarusians. When you do this analogy, let me just ask you, Ruben, and you get from there to similarly acquiesced to incursion into the Sudetenland of the Czechoslovakian nation at the time and now part of Ukraine, this would really seem to tee up the absorption of all of Czechoslovakia, or in this case, all of the Donbass, and again, be the precursor to further invasions, which the Nazis then proceeded to undertake in Poland, I guess, next. When you round it up that way, and you see the dithering of the European allies, it's a very chilling picture indeed. Do you get the sense that the Ukrainians now are going to feel that they have been abandoned and unable to resist? Or do you anticipate that if we do in fact see Putin moving beyond the Donbass particularly, there will be resistance, but maybe even as he moves beyond the areas that the so-called separatists and little green men in the past have taken for him in those two provinces of the Donbass.
But what Ukrainians they would consider themselves betrayed by some of the Europeans if there's not a dramatic rollout of punitive measures against the Russians. And Ukrainians, of course, are extremely suspicious of and cynical about the Germans in particular. There's an old Ukrainian elder statesman here. He was Ukraine's very first national security advisor ever. And he was fond of saying that there are two Russian embassies here in Kiev, but inside one of them, they only speak German. And that sort of sums up the attitude. But there is no question that Ukrainians will fight. Ukrainians are angry. Ukrainians are very, very, are just acrimonious about what's been going on. And this is a huge mistake by Vladimir Putin. This will make Ukrainians and Russians mortal enemies for, well, at least the rest of this century, I would guess, and maybe even longer. It will create a dynamic between Ukrainians and Russians, not unlike what there is between Poles and Russians.
Let me ask you in that regard, and we're almost out of time, Ruben, but just very quickly, Vladimir Putin laid out yesterday, as we're speaking, a very, well, I guess fiery is how some have described it, depiction of the history of Russia and Ukraine going back quite some time, well before the Soviet Union, which he credited with creating the modern Ukraine. What are Ukrainians making of this rendering of history by Putin? And what do you think their likely response is going to be beyond, as you say, fighting and acrimony? Is this one in which they will feel as though their future is really on the line as a people as well as a nation?
Well, yes, it's on the line, and they feel as though, first of all, Putin's retelling of history last night, actually, you would have to call his sanity into question, because it was a completely delusional picture of history. But But this is not unlike the Nazis in that they're trying to say that, oh, Ukraine as a nation doesn't exist. It's, as a people, they're not separate. They don't exist. Their culture doesn't exist. And it's an attempt to wipe a nation and its historic heritage off of the map. That's what this is. By a country that is a worse than the worst schoolyard bully you've ever seen. And they're going after Ukraine, a country which represents no threat to Russia whatsoever in any dimension. Absolutely none.
And we allow submission or worse, I believe, at our extreme peril in the West more broadly, not least because, as we'll be talking about momentarily with one of our other contributors, China is licking its chops as well.
We're hard out of time.
I have to say.
Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay.
Finish that thought, and we'll see what we can do to put it in. Go ahead, Ruben.
Okay. There's all kinds of reasons why this has huge impact, but I'll tell you the biggest reason is if Ukraine is allowed to be taken and dismembered and destroyed, anyone who's working in the non-nuclear non-proliferation business better go find another job, because there will be no more nuclear non-proliferation. After the Budapest Memorandum of 94 that guaranteed this country's borders because they gave their nukes back to Russia, no country is going to give its nuclear weapons up after this. Never, because they see what happens. Not North Korea, not Iran, nobody.
I think you're absolutely
right. That's the world we want to live in.
Interestingly enough, Putin was describing in that speech of his that Ukraine hasn't actually given up all of its nuclear weapons as part of, I think, his pretext for taking the sorts of steps that he has already taken and perhaps those that are in the offing. We are so appreciative for your on-the-street perspective on this, Ruben Johnson. I hope you'll come back to us with updates in the very near future. In the meantime, stay safe, stay well.
Thank you, sir. Have a good day. Thank you.
Out to your people in Ukraine. Next up, we will speak with Dr. Stephen Blank about what else is going on in Russia's minds, particularly that of course, Vladimir Putin, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. So it begins. As predicted in this space, now that China's genocide games are complete, Vladimir Putin has launched his long-planned invasion of Ukraine. It turns out not to be a minor incursion. Rather, the Russian dictator has clearly, by prearrangement, recognized the independence of two Ukrainian provinces in the Donbas region and moved so-called peacekeeping forces in to begin the process of annexing them to Russia. This is unlikely to be the extent of what might be called the not-so-great reset. In a speech yesterday forcefully denouncing the legitimacy of Ukraine's sovereignty, Putin made plain that his ambitions extend to the whole of that country. In the absence of the needed credible deterrence by the United States, we must expect, moreover, that Putin's communist Chinese allies, and perhaps others, will seize the opportunity for aggression as well. That will end badly. This is Frank Gaffney.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest. He's Dr. Stephen Blank. He's one of the country's foremost scholars, authors, and strategic analysts concerning the Soviet Union and the autocracy that spawned under the KGB officer known as Vladimir Putin. He is prodigiously productive, some 1,200 plus articles to his credit, and we're always very appreciative of his time. We have a chance to pick his brains, and we need it now more than ever. Dr. Blank, it's good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you for having me again, Frank. Pleasure to be there.
Thank you. Let me start by saying, we've talked a bit about how things look on the ground in Kiev at the moment, or Kyiv, I guess it's called, from the perspective of the Ukrainians in particular. I'm interested in your thoughts about how it's looking from the Kremlin, and particularly from the perspective of Vladimir Putin. What he's done to date, and this is a moving target to be sure, but whether he thinks he's getting away with murder and maybe tempted to engage in more of it.
Okay, let's start from the beginning. First of all, I hold this is not an incursion. This is an invasion. It's outright aggression. If anybody wants to talk about semantics with me, I'd be happy to do so. But this is aggression, invasion. Second, he took this particular act of sending Russian troops into these provinces that he recognizes as independent because it had become clear to him that a war was too big a risk. That is, renewed war. There's a war already going on. So a new invasion, a new operation or operations would not be a new war. It would be the same war round two or three or whatever. It became clear, I think, over the weekend, particularly when the Chinese said, we're not really happy about this, which is what they said at Munich. And the costs from the Western side were multiplying as well. The administration here played a very strong game, and that should be recognized. This is not a partisan issue in American politics. They denied him the opportunity to stage false flag invasions. They denied him the opportunity, I think, to escalate to what he wanted to do, which is take all of Ukraine, occupy Kyiv, set up a new government, and so on. The fallback solution, which, as my Russian colleague Lilia Shevtsova has just been saying elsewhere, is to occupy these two provinces, declare them independent, pending some future resolution, which remains to be seen, and at the same time, retain the pressure on Ukraine that he already has. And it's not just military, it's economic, informational, diplomatic, in the belief that he can get away with this. I think he has grievously miscalculated, frankly. But
let me ask you
already Nord Stream. Okay, Nord Stream 2 is gone. Already.
Yeah. Well, I want to come back to that, too. This is a really vital question. Is it indeed?
Sure. That pipeline has been halted.
Well,
let me just
press in on one point before we get back to the pipeline, Steve Blank, because I think it's really critical that, we'll know more later, as they say, as to whether Putin has, in fact, played out his hand fully or whether he is going to play for higher stakes elsewhere in Ukraine. But just on this question, it is a bit of a different war, even in the Donbass region, these two provinces, because the war that had been taking place, as Reuben Johnson pointed out in the previous segment, it's only part of those provinces. So to the extent that he's occupying the entirety of this region, he will, in fact, have expanded the war and have done so with, as you correctly say, an actual invasion. To this point, I'm not sure that he feels that he's been really punished, which brings me to your point about the pipeline. The Germans have to this point, as I understand it, again, this is a moving train, but they've withheld the certification that the pipeline is complete and can begin operations. That's not exactly the same thing as dismantling it or taking it down, is it?
No, but I mean, look, taking it down is a huge operation. Just physical terms. I mean, if you have audience members who work in the energy business or something comparable, they'll know that. You don't have to take it down. All you have to do is say it's not finished, it's not certified, and there'll be no gas coming through, and you've achieved your purpose. So that's fine. The occupation of the two provinces up to the line of demarcation between Ukrainian and troops and the Russian troops on the other side is, as Rubin, whom I know, said, an act of invasion. It needs to be punished as such. I'm hopeful that it will be, that Nord Stream 2 is just the first step. I think there need to be severe sanctions, the type that the president was talking about, if there is an invasion. It is, I think, essential for the United States and its allies, both in NATO and in the EU as well, to regain control of the escalation dynamic here, which is what Putin is always aiming at and trying to do. He was blocked to a certain degree here, which is why he chose this intermediate action. But it is necessary for us to make it clear that this is an invasion and will be punished. I mean, I'm thinking about writing this up as I'm talking to you, but to me, it seems that the case for bringing Ukraine into NATO now is absolutely solid. And I mean, yes, Ukraine is not a consolidated democracy. Let us grant that. It's by no means perfect. But as you know, and you were in government in the past, We've taken people into governments into NATO because they were strategically vital when they were by no means democratic. I mean, Salazar's Portugal, Franco's Spain, and the generals the colonels Greece and Turkey were all NATO members, and nobody in Washington went ballistic over this because it was strategically necessary.
But Steve, make the case that it is strategically necessary. There's a lot of talk in Washington, as you know, that we don't really have an interest in Ukraine, and it's as you say, not sufficiently democratic to be really considered worthy of our attention.
I would not overestimate that talk. That's coming out of basically one or two places,
including, of course, Russian propaganda. Let's be clear.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure. I mean, there are people there whose motives I suspect. Let me put it that way, without saying anything libelous. I don't think that propaganda has gotten any traction. There are a lot of people outside of those particular areas who don't believe Ukraine should be in NATO. I mean, or at least up until yesterday, didn't believe that. But let's be honest about what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with an invasion which threatens the entire security of Europe. And of, in particular, of members of NATO to whom we are pledged by treaty to defend their security. The fact of the matter is that NATO's frontier with Russia, no matter what Mr. Putin says, and you want to talk about the speech, is the most secure of all Russian borders and has been.
Because there's no threat, obviously, from Ukraine. Just very quickly, we've only got 30 seconds. Just give us the quick data burst on the speech itself, if you would.
The speech was an act of hysteria as well as of cynicism. Virtually everything he said was a lie. It exposed his own hysteria and obsessions about Ukraine, which are the obsessions of a lot of Russian elites. But it shows also just how badly misinformed Mr. Putin is about the West. And this idea that he's this great strategist and endless chess master calculation, I think it should be dismissed. He is a very good tactician, to give him that, but he is human, and he's what we've seen here is the human side, where passion overtook reason.
This is a point to which we will return with you very soon. Dr. Stephen Blank, you know the man well, and look forward to your further insights in all of this. Thanks for your time today. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. We'll talk next with Bill Walton about what do we do about financing our enemies. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we are joined by one of our regulars. His name is Bill Walton. He's a former president and CEO of a major Wall Street investment house, Allied Capital. He is these days the host of a terrific television podcast called The Bill Walton Show. We're always delighted to have him with us. Bill, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
Hey, Frank.
I want to sort of pivot from what we've been talking about, Bill, in terms of the sanctions that are now apparently in the offing for the aggression that Vladimir Putin and Russia have perpetrated against Ukraine to a potential target of further aggression, his partner, Xi Jinping, and the Chinese Communist Party, as they seemingly are poised, and we'll be talking more about it momentarily with Colonel Grant Newsom, to engage in some of their own aggression. Talk a little bit about the condition of the Chinese economy at the moment and whether they may be more susceptible to such pressure with deterrent effect.
Well, we've talked in the past, the Chinese economy is highly dependent on real estate, specifically residential real estate. It comprises 30% of their GDP, and compare that to roughly 16 to 17% here in the U.S. And just in January, the 100 largest property developers saw their sales fall, I'd use the word plummet, 40%. And this is continuing a 7 or 8 month decline in property sales in China. It's a big deal. China has most of its investment savings in residential real estate. The home ownership level there is roughly 90%. And the small, we've seen the big one, Evergrande, suffer, but all the smaller developers are suffering more. Their stock prices are off 60, 70%, and their sales are down 70, 80%. And it seems to be in a free-for-all. The governments have stepped in and said, look, we'll help bail you out and finance more of your unsold properties, which they hadn't been doing as much as aggressively in the past. But it's unclear that they've got the financial firewall to prevent this this erosion. And there's a great quote from one of the articles I took a look at. One of the older women said, you know, we depended on the Chinese Communist Party to preserve property values and create wealth for us. Now it's like living back in the old pre-communist China, and it's worse than ever. So this has implications for the regime.
That's really where I'm going with this, Bill, is to the extent that there are these dynamics at work in China and creating circumstances in which the hold on power of Xi Jinping may be jeopardized. Do you anticipate that that is, to all intents and purposes, an inducement to him to engage in the kind of aggression, whether it's towards Taiwan or perhaps India, or maybe even both, that he seems to be using as a kind of social engineering, at least in the abstract, if not in the very specific?
Well, some people make the optimistic point about the United States in the 21st century that demographically, we're like to see our population growing and growing younger because of immigration and higher birth rates. China, meantime, is seeing a population implosion. It's already turned the curve and it's declining. And while it's declining, it's also growing older. And its economy is, I won't say flatline, but it's not growing at the roaring rates it was growing in the past. It's down 4 or 5% recently. And with the property issues that I've just described, it's fragile. And some people say that's good news. Well, I don't think it is good news, because a weakened adversary is more likely to strike than someone who feels like they're operating from strength. And China's not made a lot of friends around its borders in the last 20, 25 years with its aggressions, and also what it's done internally in terms of the Uyghurs and forced organ harm plants. And this Olympics was hardly the PR triumph they hoped. I think Xi's probably looking to disappear the people who decided that the ski jump ought to be located next to an abandoned steel mill. That was quite a dystopian image. But I think all this increases the risk that they're going to do something about Taiwan. Now, I know our friend Gordon Chang thinks it'll be a few years off, and that may be true, but I think both Xi and Putin and any of the other bad actors are looking at Biden and the incredibly weak foreign policy team and national defense team that Biden has, and they're saying the time to act is now.
I'm with you. We're going to explore this very pregnant question with Colonel Grant Newsom in a moment. And I think his he's leaning towards it maybe being a little further off. We'll see. But in the meantime, Bill, we certainly are watching partners or at least colleagues of yours in the past riding to the rescue of the Chinese Communist Party to a degree that I continue to be just astounded by. Charlie Munger, a considerable friend of China, I think it's fair to say, has taken to task one of the principal, engines of that kind of bailout, namely Larry Fink of BlackRock. Walk us through what's going on there and whether it has any significant insights for us as to where Wall Street is headed in this moment.
Well, Larry Fink has led an ascendancy of woke investors and CEOs in the last couple of years, and he's one of several large money managers. He runs BlackRock, of course, but there's also Vanguard and State Street, and together they control over 20% of all the market cap in the New York Stock Exchange and the S&P 500. And they've used that clout, though, not to encourage companies to increase their returns. Instead, they're encouraging them to go up along with the ESG agenda, environmental social governance, which we've talked about extensively, has very little to do with increasing shareholder returns. And here you have Warren Buffett's longtime partner, Charlie Munger. Charlie's 98. Charlie can call it as he sees it. And I think he was quoted recently saying, we have a whole bunch of new bunch of emperors, and they're the people who vote the shares in the index funds. And by that, he means Vanguard, BlackRock, and State Street. And he says, I think the world of Larry Fink, and he does. Charlie's a very progressive liberal, but I'm not sure I want him to be my emperor. And so you get some hard-headed people like Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger, who are the best asset allocators on the planet, looking at what Larry Fink's doing and saying, look, guys, you're not aiming my investment dollars at targets that are going to increase my returns. Instead, they're going to make you feel good and make you feel woke. But maybe you ought to get back to your business, which is increasing returns to your shareholders. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out. There are a lot of us that are calling out these money managers now, and I think we're beginning to have some effect.
I hope so, Bill. It's vital that these individual, masters of the universe.
Frank, their arrogance is overweening. Larry writes, employees are increasingly looking to their employers as the most trusted, competent, and ethical source of information. Think about that. I mean, you're working in a Fortune 500 company, whatever, and you're looking at your employer as your most trusted source of information. I don't think so.
Right. Well, you've been there, and I think it's
it's
vital that
I would have liked more of that.
I like to think they're getting some of their information from programs like ours. But Bill, let me ask you this: when you see this kind of perturbations in the force, maybe you might call it, it's really important, and I know that we sort of revert to this most of the time we talk about this subject, but I don't think it can be said often enough. Whether it's Larry Fink or whether it's his counterparts at Vanguard or State Street or any place else on the street, it's our money that they're doing this with, investing in China, maybe even recklessly investing in China for sure. But at a minimum, it is helping enable the mortal enemy that we confront. And I'm with Charlie Munger to this point. I certainly don't want Larry Fink imperially disposing of our resources, whether it's taxpayer funds or whether it's veterans or
this relates to our earlier topic, Frank. I said China has a primitive capital market. Most of its savings dollars are tied up in residential real estate, which is in a precarious spot, and bank accounts, and they've got no other way really to put their money to work. And China's enlisted Vanguard, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan to come in and modernize its capital markets, in effect helping bail out the Chinese Communist Party. The number two guy, the chief operating officer at JP Morgan, was interviewed recently, and they still see China as a growth market. and they're not paying attention to the sort of things that they ought to be paying attention to, which is America's security and the unfortunate human rights violations that the Chinese Communist Party is guilty of.
Those are things you'd like to think every American is focused on, and especially when it does come to your money being disposed of in ways that might be very harmful to our national security. But I think the other piece of it is that even on the business side, Bill, what you're talking about doesn't seem to be making a lot of sense, given where they're putting that money and the likelihood that the shareholders are going to benefit. We have to leave it at that, Bill. I'm afraid we're hard out of time, but I just want to say thank you, as always, for your insights into all of these matters and the extent to which you're bringing to bear a lot of hard-earned experience in the field, and it's really appreciated that you share it with our audience. Hope you come back to us again next week. Thank you for your time today. Next up, we'll speak with Colonel Grant Newsom right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we're joined by Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps, retired. He is a former Foreign Service officer and businessman in the Western Pacific. These days he's a research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies and a senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy. He frequently contributes to the public policy debate at Epoch Times and Asia Times. We're always delighted to have him here at Secure Freedom Radio and Securing America. Colonel Newsom, we've been talking about what is taking place on the continent of Europe, where Vladimir Putin has both massed forces and now begun sending them into neighboring Ukraine across the border from Russia. I'd love to get your take on all of this as a military man, as well as a deep strategic thinker. What do you make of it?
Well, the Russian army in the last 20 years has actually gotten very good. While America has been focused elsewhere, Iraq, Afghanistan, the Russians have built up a very capable ground force that has all the support that it needs to roll over things if it wants to. So militarily, they're in pretty good shape. But what one really notes is the political, psychological aspect of what Putin has just done. He has moved his troops into Eastern Ukraine in these two breakaway parts that he claims he has had nothing to do with. And now he's called the West Bluff. He's called America's Bluff. He has sent his troops in, says these are Russian territory, and what are you going to do about it? And the significance here that you always have to remember is Ukraine is an independent country. It is the biggest democracy in Europe, depending on how you calculate it. And here you have another country, Russia, which is a member of the United Nations Security Council, has taken the eastern part of Ukraine and already took Crimea, that section down to the southeast. So it has about one-fifth of Ukraine. It's just taken it. And now he has moved his troops in. He has just removed even that sort of the lie that was being said that, well, these are just Ukrainians who don't like Ukraine and want to be part of Russia. He's moved his troops in, seized the place, and now he's told the White House, okay, what are you going to do? So from a political perspective, the West is in a bind. Because is this enough to go to war over? What do you do? And so that's, you have to sort of grudgingly admire, as you know, scary as it is, what Putin has done. But it is a shame the things have gotten to this point.
It is a shame, and it may not be the end of it. Do you anticipate that he will consolidate his winnings with the entirety of the Donbass, only a part of which, you know, had actually been occupied by his surrogates or his little green men, as they say, the mercenaries working for Russia prior to this incursion? Or do you think that he understands that if he went further, if he actually took more of Ukraine, that would really rip it and there would now be very considerable consequences for him, probably more than he wants to bear?
Oh, I don't think he's done at all. These kind of people, these kind of regimes never are. They may wait a while, and you'll find the Americans, the West, like to think, oh, he's had enough. He's afraid of what comes next. But no, this is just the start. He will keep going as long as he can. I think he is serious when he says he wants to take back what he thinks was the former Soviet Union and are now independent countries. I would take him very seriously. That speech that he gave where he said that, that made your skin crawl. He was saying what he's going to do if he can. So I don't think we're done by any means.
We're on notice, in other words, let alone not done. Colonel Grant Newsom, one of the considerations for him, presumably, is not only the relative weakness of those who might oppose him, but the apparent strong support he is now enjoying from communist China. You've studied China very closely over your military career and, of course, now having left uniform. What is the exact status, as you see it, of the relationship between these two nations that have, well, at times been at war with one another and certainly have some, shall we say, deviating interest in the ultimate state of affairs, notably with respect to, say, Siberia, the eastern parts of Russia. And how is that bearing, as you see it, on Putin's present calculations about what he can get away with?
I think that Putin has got Chinese support for whatever he does in the West, and vice versa. This is a marriage of convenience. So people will point out, well, the Russians and the Chinese really don't like each other. They have this history. The Chinese want Russia's eastern territories in Siberia because they were taken from them, they think. So there's nothing to worry about. Well, in actual fact, despite those problems, they are glad to cooperate and to have each do things that discombobulate, that bother the Americans, that bother the West. It's in some respects mutually reinforcing. And that needs to be remembered. And, you know, the Russian-German pact in 1939, those were two countries leaders of which did not like each other. Yet they cooperated in a way that caused us no end of harm. And that is, I think, the best way to look at the Russia-China relationship.
Now, this really does seem, in so many respects, to have historical antecedents. They say history doesn't repeat itself, but rhymes, and this may be an example of very similar circumstances arising and thugs in Russia and China both responding to those circumstances in ways that, as you say, will cost us dearly. As you look at China and the West, as you say, there's going to be, unfortunately, an aspect to this almost certainly with respect to China and the East. And I want to get into this in more detail with you momentarily, but for just the present purpose, you have been among those warning vociferously, Grant Newsom, about the Chinese Communist Party's appetite for reestablishing, if you will, or establishing, I think is a bit more accurate historically, control over Taiwan. And the implications of that for not just the people of Taiwan, of course, but for vital U.S. interests in the region and beyond. And we're going to talk much more about all of that with you on the other side of a very short break. We'll be right back. Stay tuned for more with Colonel Grant Newsom.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back and we're joined once again by Colonel Grant Newsom. We were talking with him earlier about Ukraine. I want to pivot now to the Western Pacific and specifically what the Chinese Communist Party is up to in its sphere of influence as it sees it. Specifically with respect to the island nation, and I use that term advisedly, of Taiwan. Colonel, you've studied this closely. You've been involved in defense planning and strategy vis-a-vis Taiwan for decades. How do you see the Chinese appetite in this moment with Putin distracting the West rather dramatically at the moment? That with the genocide games behind them, the Chinese decks are now clear for action against Taiwan? And if so, in what form do you think it'll take?
Well, the Chinese are serious. You know, when they say they are going to take Taiwan, they've never controlled Taiwan. And the entire Chinese nation, such as it is for 5,000 years, has only had some loose authority over Taiwan for about 10 years during the Qing dynasty, and they were not even Chinese. So they would be taking what is effectively, by all measures, an independent, free nation. That they're serious when they say they're going to do it, and they will do it by intimidation or by actual force if they have to. I think they see what's going on in Europe, and they are taking notes, particularly if Putin is allowed to get away with taking part of an independent country and get away with it. That the Chinese will like their odds, and they will be screaming that, oh, we're just taking what is rightfully ours, even though that's a lie. But there will be a constituency in the United States, in the West, that agrees with them and or doesn't want the trouble of taking on the Chinese. But the Chinese are sorely tempted, and they say they've been clear what they're going to do, and we need to take them seriously.
Well, let's talk about what that might entail. There are seemingly two basic options, and I think you alluded to them. Physical takeover of the island by an invasion, an amphibious, multi-dimensional, and I think it's fair to say pretty challenging attack, or possibly just sort of strangling the island, its economy, its people, I guess, with a blockade into submission. Bookmake for me on which of those options do you think the Chinese will go for, in part informed by Sun Tzu, you know, the ancient Chinese strategist who said it's better to win without fighting if you can.
I think in 2022, this year, I don't think China is going to attack Taiwan. I think they like what they see. They see America in chaos of sorts. They see a sort of a confused, kind of weak administration, unfortunately. They see what's going on in Europe, and it looks like Putin's going to be able to take part of an independent nation, claiming that it was always his, and it looks like he just might get away with it. So, and Chinese political warfare throughout the Pacific is quietly undercutting the American position. China is racking up allies or people who cooperate with it throughout the region, and that works to both a political and a military advantage. So if you just wait and let things simmer, that from China's perspective, that may be worth waiting a bit and see if you can demoralize the Taiwanese to the point they feel like the Americans won't or can't protect them and nobody else will. And at that point, you might be able to get the Taiwanese to submit. And if you could get one of your front men, say, to assert himself or get to the top politically in Taiwan, it just takes one Quisling, that would work very well too. And you've avoided all the trouble of an actual armed invasion. And there's, of course, military force you can use below the level of a D-Day-like assault on the country, and that you're going to see that stepping up as well. So for this year, I don't see an attack. But after that, after 2022, I have no confidence at all. I think if China thinks that the West, the Americans, are not going to do much other than complain and maybe put on a few sanctions, that I think they'll be sorely tempted to pull the trigger and launch a military assault.
I'll be very interested to see whether they have that patience. They're known for their patience, of course, but it does seem to me that there's such a window of opportunity here, and it may prompt them to act more promptly, if I can use that expression. When you look at the strategic equities here, Colonel Newsom, we're likely to hear, not just among the, well, quislings, I guess one might put it, the elite that's been captured in the United States by the Chinese Communist Party, the people who would either avert their gaze or, you know, willingly submit to the Chinese, some who will simply say, look, we just don't have a dog in this fight. why is that wrong, as you see it, morally, strategically, and certainly militarily?
Well, that's the right question, and it's fair for people who don't live and breathe this stuff. You would might ask, well, what's the big deal with Taiwan? Well, here's what it is China wants to push America out of Asia. If you take Taiwan, they'll have done that. The American commitment, implicit at least, to protect 24 million people, free people, free Chinese people, that will have been just demolished. And at that point, who else is going to trust the Americans? And that's not just in the region, that's going to be throughout the world. And you will be giving these regimes, you know, the Russians, the Chinese, the Iranians, you're going to really be encouraging them if that happens. Additionally, from a purely military standpoint, Taiwan is key terrain. It's right in the middle of America's defense lines. So if Taiwan goes, well, the Chinese have free access to the Pacific, and you will see the Chinese military just operating all over the place in the Pacific and into Latin America, up into Central America. So you could reach a point at which America is like Finland, really big Finland during the Soviet era. It cannot do anything major without getting Chinese permission. And it's that dominance which the Chinese really seek. And that is within reach, I think they see. So Taiwan is the thing. If it goes, everything else.
I very much agree with that and fear that that's what's in prospect. Just a quick 15 seconds on the supply of advanced chips out of Taiwan and how important that is.
Oh, it's important. You know, it's about 90% of high-end chips come from Taiwan. And a lot of the rest do too. But we can always build chip factories. You may be interruptions, of course, but I think those can be rebuilt. Even if there were no chip factories on Taiwan, the island would still be just as attractive to the Chinese communists as with chips. Chips are just gravy from the Chinese perspective.
Colonel, we'll be watching this closely with your help, I know, going forward. Thank you for your time today. And thanks to the rest of you for joining us for this edition of Secure Freedom Radio and Securing America. We are very pleased to have you with us and hope that you will check out our website, securingamerica.tv. And until then, I hope that you'll stay engaged in helping us secure America and then go forth and multiply. This is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.